This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Bob Hickok is here from Virginia Tech, and it's about time. We have waited and waited for him. He does something with poetry that no one else does. And today we'll find out what it is and why. And he's going to open with an opening poem.
The Big Book of Therapy. If you think of humans as rare as snowflakes, your world is constantly melting. If you think of humans as essential to keeping dogs happy, someone will always want to buy you a beer.
That's the voice of Bob Hickok, who has changed logic to be better than it was before. And this is a new book. We're premiering it. I don't know, is it actually on the shelf yet?
I don't know if any books are on shelves anymore. It's on the Amazon shelf,
okay,
I believe.
Okay, so that it's really
the digital shelf.
You can hold it in your hand.
Yes, you can throw it at someone.
No, not this book. No.
It's heavy enough. It would do a good job.
It has more than 100 poems in it. Tell me how you describe it.
It is the group of poems I wrote primarily over the last 2 or 3 years. That is my entire description of the book.
A book that comes out about every 3 years?
Yes.
Oh, it's regular. Well, I will tell everyone then that these poems are startling in the way that they take disparate images, hip-hop ideas, pop culture, social problems, and they all become lucid for some reason. He can take so many fractured elements, and when you finish the poem, for some reason, it all is one narrative. And we will see that today. He's known for his wit. He's known for his social action. And there's love in every poem, and I'll prove that with what we hear. So let's hear a poem. Bob Hickok at the Library of Congress.
Thank you for saying that. That was very nice. Career day. Were I a stenographer, I'd write down everything Rain says. Mm-hmm. A camper, I'd set up a tent in the Rothko room at the Phillips. A heroin addict, I'd live in the 90s. Jesus, I'd change it to the last brunch. Quiche Lorraine, mimosas. I'd not take a police psychologist job for anything in the world other than the world. Mm-hmm. And why do we say, shot his brains out, when there's just the one? Were I a priest, I'd only do straight weddings and gay weddings together, couples lined up down the aisle and around the block. Let there be happiness and love in bulk. Were I a star, I'd shine binary. Were I smart, I'd have been Jane Goodall and kept my mouth shut. Why tell humans apes are great when humans are terrible at leaving apes and well enough alone? But I am dust, and as such, I'll eat an apple and be happy to give my shovel a treasure map and beg the two of them to dig the world. Were I a pun, hun, I wouldn't be that one. Were I the Big Bang, I'd whisper in the ears of flowers, take your time, this was all for you.
Bob Hickok, I love the way you end every poem. It always is just another stripe of color in it. That is not in this book. Is it a new poem?
No, I wrote that a couple days ago.
So are we getting all new poems?
No. There'll be some. I tend to prefer reading new poems, but for some reason today I decided not to.
But it's fun to have something no one has ever heard before. Are we the first people, or did you tell it to someone in your house?
The only person who tends to see my poems before I send them out is Eve, and I read that one to her.
Okay, so after Eve.
They go out?
We know. It was us.
Yes.
We got it.
Yes.
Bob Hickok is here with a premiere poem, and I hope a few more of them. I feel it's a privilege to be the first ones after Eve. As you can see from that poem, a lot of things are going on. I often said I would love to MRI your brain, right? Because we have Jane Goodall. We have an icon in American culture. You use a lot of American culture figures. There's a lot of whimsy in your work. There's irony. And sometimes you get really mad.
Yes.
So a lot goes on with you. What we don't know is how it works. We don't understand the glue that you use that makes it so understandable. Do you?
No.
Okay, well then we can just move on. Let's have another poem. If we're all in this together.
This is called Objectivity.
A new poem.
No, this is one from the book. Now that cell phones come with a conscience, we know that the moment he gave in, the second the wind left his body and he accepted the orthodoxy of your cup fist, was 19 punches before you quit. Beside your smile, another fact the video makes clear, equality means either you stop beating black jaywalkers or start beating me.
There's many poems in your book, the new book Hold, that have to do with brutality and with police brutality for African Americans. And this is a stuck in your craw.
Yes, very much.
And it seems that the one particular, I think it's called Mirror. No, I forget the title of the poem, but it ends with, "This is hunting."
Yeah.
This is hunting.
Yeah.
And you call it just what it is. So I want to thank you for those poems, which make a difference. They do make a difference. Let me tell people who you are. This Hold, the book Hold, there's no title poem Hold, though.
No.
But there's a lot of holds in the poems.
Yeah.
Okay. And this has just come out by Copper Canyon. And it is your eighth book.
Ninth.
Yep. Ninth book. Okay. And we will tell you a couple of the other titles. Elegy Ode, finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. This Clumsy Living, that was the Bobbitt Prize from the Library of Congress in 2008. That is big time. Words for Empty and Words for Full, that was 2010. Insomnia Dire, 2004. Animal Soul, that was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. You know, we would be here late if I read them all, but he has received the Felix Pollack Prize in Poetry, the ALA Book List Notable Book of the Year, 8 Pushcart Prizes, a Guggenheim, NEA Fellowships, the best of American poetry. And he is truly one of the most popular poets in America, which is an interesting thing because your poetry is very challenging. It is very challenging.
Thank you.
And it is interesting that you have a huge fan base because it looks like people can sit still long enough to read poetry that is very complicated.
I would hope so.
Bob Hickok, give us some more. Give us 2 in a row so we really know you.
Zing. To this day, I like licking 9 volts, the zots from the cold metal poles. And I'm sorry a little bit that licking my wife isn't like that. A little bit that air isn't 120 volts, that I can't plug my table saw into a cloud. On the other hand, I haven't tried. Haven't opened a window in a plane and reached into this possible communication. Or said to a doctor, how can an enlarged heart be a bad thing? Such as yesterday at the hospital when my mom's swollen ticker afforded me the chance to interject thus. I have to tell you, my wife won't like the start of this poem, or when her grandmother dies, or when drought kills her flowers. Even if I tell her it's an evolution to tatters I find lovelier than when the breeze was lithe with the currents of their blooms. But I may not be the best judge of beauty or anything.
Mm.
I lick batteries, remember? It's like electroshock for cowards, like practicing French kissing lightning or American kissing thunder, a jolt of enthusiasm, spritz of wake-up sent arrowing to the brain. Mine lives in a cave with the lights off. Is that why sorrow grows like mold? God, I have questions. Why don't zealots see how boring they are? Does birdsong really travel better in morning air? Answers will arrive in pieces that may or may not resemble the whole. And one day when I shiver, it'll be my skin feeling your eyes walking across this poem.
Oh, your poems have such self-confidence.
I feel complete confidence while I write. And I have no confidence as soon as I'm done. But while I write, I don't think in the way that allows doubt to come in. And once I have a sense of a poem having hit a critical mass and I believe it will have a life, I am able to complete them almost without fail. But as soon as I'm done, I hate my poems.
It conveys, it is conveying that sense that it belongs, that every word is entitled. And I don't know any other poet that exactly has that, exactly like that. But don't you believe that you are a risk taker in writing?
I've never liked that phrase applied to poetry because there's no real danger. The actual danger is not being aggressive. The way you hurt yourself in writing is if you don't go big, whatever big is for you. So risk, the way we talk about it, has always confused me, because if you want people to be interested in what you do, there has to be some shine, some shake to what you put down on the page. So the risk is actually in being inappropriately quiet for whatever it is you do. A quiet poet would naturally have a way of being loud within that quietude. So whatever loud is for each of us, you need to be loud because you're competing, we're competing against television,
and
movies.
And you say, as many times as television shoots poetry in the head, it still goes on. But there are a variety of things.
Yes.
A variety.
The hard thing for me is I end up sort of being in love with people who can just have one thing in a poem, and they focus on that, and they don't move away from that. That's hard for me to do, and I find it appealing, but it's not what I naturally do.
But they're not Bob Hickok, and so we
and
do not love them.
For it.
So we want to hear another one. Okay. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're with someone who is admired by many people.
We've come a long way toward getting nowhere. My obsession with Jews is an obsession with one Jew. I look at her walking and wonder what anyone could have against Jews, at her sleeping or hunting for her keys in the morning, which she does often, lose her keys when she has to go to work, suggesting she doesn't want to. And maybe this is the problem with Jews. They don't want to leave. Or they eat lots of chicken, or worry the black of their skirts doesn't match the black of their tops. Or like children more than babies, or fret over their mothers. My Jewish problem is figuring out why America in 2016 has a dab of 1930s German fascism to it. People at political rallies yelling crap about the Jews. If I thought it would do any good, I'd go to Topeka or wherever and bring Eve with her troubled wardrobe and her love of chicken and fascination with children between 2 and 13. When they can talk, but before they've begun planning the murder of their parents. Bring her face to face with the screamers and ask, "So these are the freckles you hate?"
Oh.
I would. We have a lot of Amex points, and I've never been to Topeka or wherever. And I'm sure wherever is very nice. And whenever we travel to wherever, whatever people say and however they say it, Eve's freckles will be the same, kind of cute and kind of Jewish. Just like all her other parts that do and do not have freckles, in an inventory I alone get to take, though trust me, after repeated inspection, I can attest that underneath it all, she, like many of the people you know or are, is ticklish, wrinkly, sexy, scarred, since Jews really are relentless when it comes to being human.
Mm. What a last line. What a first line. I think we could kill anti-Semitism with freckles. That line.
I like imagining that battle.
So these are the freckles you hate. So these are the freckles you hate. What a thing to say. That could melt a supremacist.
We would hope.
And a typical Bob Hickok poem, he gets the idea, and then he thinks about it, then he sits down. Then he sketches it out. How many? No?
No. I've come to believe that poetry is fundamentally a performative act. I think of it a lot like athletics. We train ourselves to do these things over and over, but what you're training yourself really to do is to perform in a very short period of time that which you do. I write, typically it takes me an hour, hour and a half to write a poem. I get up every day around 4:30 or 5. I've done this every day now for, going on 30 years. So I have trained myself to sit down, notice whatever is moving across my mind that draws my attention. I pick that up, put it into whatever language is interesting in the moment, and I follow where that goes. That's what writing is to me. So I think of poems as records of where my mind was at in the moment I wrote that poem.
So you're saying that discipline is being a disciple to writing.
Yes.
And you are saying that there's something about faith.
Yes.
That we do. And I like the analogy with the athlete, because it is a training. We are always in training.
Is.
If you ever get mushy or sloppy or take off,
right.
It's hard to get
it's
back.
It's hard to get that rhythm
yeah,
back.
It
and
is.
I know people are different. There's a friend of mine who needs attention to build up. He doesn't like the act of writing the way I do. So he fights it. He stays away. And he writes when he has to.
Well, then you don't especially start with a feeling.
Generally, it is a feeling, thought, idea, kind of a mix of all of those.
Because you're feeling all the time then.
Yes.
Maybe that's our job.
I think it is.
To be ready.
People who do what we do, one of the things we've learned, I mean, a lot of what the brain does is inhibit. I think what people like us have learned to do is not inhibit certain parts of our brain. So there is a part of all our minds that is producing language, parts. We attend to those to a degree and in a way that other people don't, and where they would probably tend to tamp down or ignore, we pay attention to.
That's a very good,
revere.
Almost scientific explanation. Very good.
Thank
it
you.
Says a lot. But somewhere you, more than others, learned there were so many words, that language was unending, that it was a constant fountain. I mean, somewhere you learned that there was a lot of words.
Yes.
To draw from. Now, where did that come from?
I don't know. I think the kind of thing you're touching on, I think, is probably innate.
Ah.
And that I would fall into a subset of what we do. There would be a group of us for whom... writing is almost like reaching into this river that is constantly going by. And we do it, and then we walk away. So it's kind of an oddity that I've come to this. I was actually a math science guy. I would have gone that way, I think, if poetry had not shown up. But that was where I was headed.
I can see that.
And I'm still not a natural...
I can see that. There's a precision... There's a love of accuracy. There's a way of balance and an equilibrium that is, I think, very much like mathematics. But this is Bob Hickok. I am Grace Cavalieri. I am happy he's here because we're going to hear another poem. Tell us what book is from.
This is from the current book, Hold. In Zoo News Today, animals have trusted me. However else I failed to make it to the Olympics, fold a flag properly, resolve or even understand tensions in the Middle East, animals have trusted me. A few of them human, one of them human, one half of one of them human. The rest of her, I don't know what she is. I'm thinking an otter floating on its back in Monterey Bay, smashing abalone open with a rock. If you sit still long enough, hummingbirds will come right up to your nose to see if it's a flower. It's not, in case you're wondering, enough to say first do no harm. You have to first do no harm and second do no damage and third stick your hand out for new dogs to sniff. In another life I was a dog who thought in another life I was a person who thought in another life I was better at whatever this is. Going this is so fast, I often want to put on the brakes and hug an elephant or what else feels as big as desire feels. Whales are the only other corollary, and did I just call the love of my life half an otter? I apologize. She's full bore, full tilt otter. And abalone, sorry. And time, slow down. Put your feet up, please.
These are all love poems.
That's
pretty much
what I tend to do, I think.
Yes, I think even when you're talking about white supremacy, you're talking about the opposite, which you love.
Yeah.
And animals and horses and...
And Eve.
She's become kind of a myth in your work. Her freckles. Well, let's see what happens in the next poem.
If it's not fixable, don't break it. The neighbors with a little pond filled in the little pond. The frogs bothered them. The rhythmic sexual thrum of wanting to get laid, wanting to go on being frogs with the purity of focus I can only dream of bringing to the essential work of my species, which vacillates between killing everything we see and trying to have a conversation with clouds. But the frogs won in the end, or in the middle, since the parade isn't over. Water came back. Water got down on one knee, looked over the land, and realized that for all the hubbub, my neighbors are not civil engineers. There was still a bowl where there had been a bowl, just a different bowl, and water respects all bowls equally. Then water did what it was raised from a pup to do, flowed and filled, after which the frogs resumed their calling of doing it. For by doing it, it will have been done. And it having been done, they can move on to the important task of doing it again. My breathing agrees 100% with this philosophy. Over and over, in with the fire, out with the ashes, in with the shimmery aura surrounding every little heartbeat and twig, out with a riderless horse crossing the snow.
Mm.
Where death fails, humping succeeds. That's all rock and roll has been saying.
And you say if Mick Jagger didn't exist, we'd have to invent him. That's another one of your epigraphs.
Yes.
Well, I think I know how to write a poem now. I mean, we don't ever know, really, until we do it
right.
every day.
Right.
But now, all of a sudden, I know something else I didn't know before. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I know something new today. Before we have a final poem, if you can just tell your students what you told us, is that enough?
I think it has to be.
It's a good beginning, isn't it?
I think it has to be.
What else can there be to said?
Yeah. I think the importance is on some level to embody it, to demonstrate not just in how you write, but in how you talk about poems. I think how we look at poetry should in some way mimic or reflect how we write. And the combination of what we say and how we look at other people's work, I think that's all we can do to convey to students how they might go about this.
And then do you think they live a different way?
Students, I think so. I think this has a great deal to do with how you live your life. I don't think being involved in anything passionately is independent of how you carry yourself. And I think being wed to the arts, any art, makes you a more receptive, more empathic, more sympathetic person. Certainly not all. I mean, we both probably know a lot of poets, and that's not the case with all of us, and nor painters or anyone else. But I think this kind of involvement connects you more deeply to the world and brings you to society as just a better person.
The best kind of life.
Yeah, I have.
I think. Yeah, the best kind of life. Who do you write for, though, when you write?
Myself. I do not think about anyone else while I write. It's one of the things I think we've done a bit service with. One of the notions we'll give students is you have to think about your reader. You do not want to be thinking about anyone else while you write. When you're done, you certainly, if you're going to send off poems, that kind of thing, you have to think about who's on the other end. But to try to get at your mind.
But to create?
No, you can't pass your mind through someone else's mind and end up in your mind. It doesn't work.
You need to do a bunch of TED Talks. Really? People need to know
this. But they would be
this.
Bob Talks. And it's not the same thing.
It wouldn't be the same thing.
No.
It'd be iconoclastic. Let's have a final poem.
Okay. I'll read a new poem. This is called Sigh. Either crickets, frogs, or Republicans will become extinct here in a few decades as temps rise. Or bees, apple trees, mosquitoes. No one knows what will go, just that the going is coming to a desert knee pasture or budding floodplain near you. I've told the grubs to pack and head north, mice to stock up on umbrellas and water, the Roanoke River to stick out its thumb and hit the road, but they listen about as well as we do to ourselves. I've always liked that apocalypse rhymes with taco chips and believed nothing's impossible for us except walking through walls, levitating, and changing in fundamental ways. Having painted ourselves into a corner in a burning house on a sinking ship lost at sea, we're doing what we do best, waiting for the Super Bowl to see which ads are funniest.
Oh.
How does one species apologize to another? Dear dung beetle, we've done you wrong. Dear maple tree, we've left you as much snow in Canada as we could. All suffering is local, and most places are elsewhere, and everyone is someone else but you. These are the mountains empathy, collective action, and planning have to climb. The amazing human brain is a gun pointed at itself. As much as I love my wife and green hills and blue skies and life, I hate this poem, that I could write it with our eyes closed.
That is quintessential Bob Hickok. And this is the
poem.
For
better or worse.
And I want to tell you, I think that's my favorite poem.
Oh, thank
but
you.
But always, the last one is always my favorite poem. That is the meaning of eternity. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support from the Snippet Fund and Old Fox Bookstore in Annapolis, Maryland. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.